Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Archbishop Vincent Nicholls is installed as the new leader in Westminster and head of the church in England and Wales. Plus, Britain's Secretary of State for Northern Ireland visits the Vatican and talks about the ongoing expenses scandal rocking Parliament. Stay tuned.
God, our Father, our Shepherd and Guide, look with love on your servant Vincent, your appointed pastor of this church. May his word and example inspire and guide your church. May he and all those in his care come to the joy of everlasting life. We ask this through Christ our Lord.
The Most Reverend Vincent Gerard Nicholls, formerly Archbishop of Birmingham, was installed as the new Archbishop of Westminster on Thursday, surrounded by an impressive lineup of cardinals, bishops, the papal nuncio, and ecumenical guests, including the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Anglican Bishop of London. At midday, the bells of Westminster Cathedral rang out across the city and a fanfare was played as the Archbishop knelt at the threshold for the start of a pontifical mass for his reception as the 11th head of the Diocese of Westminster and leader of the Church in England and Wales.
My brothers and sisters, I welcome you most warmly and I thank you all for coming to Westminster Cathedral today.
Archbishop Nicholls is no stranger to the church in the British capital. After studying at the English College here in Rome and being ordained in 1969, he served as General Secretary of the Bishops' Conference before being named as an auxiliary in London, the youngest bishop in Britain at that time. In the year 2000, he was named as the Archbishop of Birmingham, and in 2005, he became well known by wider audiences for his commentaries with the BBC during Pope John Paul II. Second's funeral. Just after he was appointed to his new job, I spoke to Archbishop Nicholls to find out how he felt about the daunting task ahead.
Well, when I was approached by the nuncio and he told me that it was the desire and the wish of the Holy Father that I would succeed Cardinal Cormac, well, I swallowed hard and said yes, because that's what my life's about, just wanting to play a part in the mission of the church under the obedience of the church. So it wasn't in that sense a decision that I had to make, but it's something I have to learn to cope with, because it is a daunting prospect.
Those who know you best describe you as a very ambitious man. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think I am ambitious for the things of God. I just want to serve the church and to serve its mission, and I don't mind where I do it. I don't mind. It doesn't make any difference to me where that is. That's the only ambition I have.
Taking over there in Westminster, what do you see as the greatest challenges facing the church today?
Well, the challenges that face the Archbishop of Westminster essentially are the same as those that face every bishop in this country, but sometimes they're writ rather more large in the capital city and with the intensity of the media being centred in London. And also, I think some of the voices that are raised against the church are probably more strident in London than anywhere else. In many parts of the country, there are very good relationships between the churches and public authorities. Here, they seem to be more strained. And I would want and hope to be able to address that interface between the culture of the capital and the life of faith of the capital, along with other faith leaders and other church leaders.
You have been quite outspoken in addressing the problem of the secular media in Britain before. You've talked about an anti-Catholic agenda, particularly at the BBC. Do you think this is likely to continue?
Well, the BBC is a very large and complicated organisation, and I don't recall ever having said that the BBC as a whole is anti-Catholic. I think what happened for me was that there were one or two pockets and enterprises within the wider BBC that was certainly, in my view, conducting itself wrongly. And that's what I was protesting about. At other times, the BBC is wonderfully cooperative. You just have to think of the funeral of Pope John Paul II, when the BBC gave the best coverage around the world of anybody. So there is a lot of cooperation and shared work with the media in this country, and I wouldn't want it caricatured as purely oppositional, because it isn't.
You're well known for your work in the fields of ecumenism and interfaith dialogue, particularly with the Muslim community up there in Birmingham, where you've been. Do you see this as a priority as you take over in Westminster?
Well, I look forward to learning a lot about the pattern of interfaith dialogue in Westminster. I know there's been a tradition on the ground of great work done in the diocese through the Interfaith Network. I'm not sure what happens in terms of leadership. Certainly in Birmingham, that has been a great strong point for us. And I was glad to be able to say this morning that I knew many people would be praying for me, including Muslims, Jews, and Sikhs in particular, in the city of Birmingham. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to say.
You've also been in the forefront of the church's efforts to try and overcome this very painful episode of sex abuse within the church. Do you think this is something that you have really been able to put behind you as a church, and that you will be able to move into your new job without having to worry too much about this now?
I think overall, yes, with the caveat that those who have been deeply traumatized through being abused, perhaps in their childhood, they are very important, and we constantly have to try and be sensitive and give attention to that enduring pain. I think from a managerial point of view, we are past that, and that perhaps the signal of that is there's no longer great media interest in the remaining cases that we have to deal with and act properly. But there is always a compassion to be extended to anyone who is really suffering, especially if that's happened within the life of the church.
Archbishop Vincent Nicholls there, speaking just after his nomination as the 11th Archbishop of Westminster. While he may be spending most of his time in the British capital now, Vin, as he's always been called by his friends, is very much a product of the church in his native Liverpool, where he worked immediately following his ordination. That's the view of the current Archbishop of Liverpool and outgoing Vice President of the Bishops' Conference, Patrick Kelly.
I think that what he received and the character which formed him really from Liverpool is going to be quite a strength. From relatively ordinary background, from going to schools here, which are still here today, somebody deeply aware of the challenges that face the city and who served in several of our, well, quite demanding parishes and with distinction. So I think all of that has given him a grounding, which means that besides bringing his knowledge of the situation in London and all that that means, and it's a very complex reality, he'll also have this other dimension to him, which I think will give him a breadth which will be very welcome.
You're saying he worked in quite difficult parishes. You mean
Indeed.
He has a particularly able way, a good human touch, if you like, with people in
Absolutely.
Difficult situations?
I mean, the impression I have, though, of course, it was a long time before I came, but I'm very aware that people greatly appreciated what he did. And this very day I had a letter from somebody saying how much they'd appreciated what he offered in terms of accessible formation.
He is, as you say, a Liverpudlian. He's very proud of it too, isn't he?
Very proud of it. In fact, today, which I think is marvellous, the Liverpool Post, our main local paper, has a double-page spread, which is both gracious and generous and positive. So that, again, it's a marvellous way. He obviously gave an interview. And again, that's a sign that he's willing to cooperate with our local media, because what is there today lifts us all up on what I'm afraid is going to be a dark day in these islands with the Dublin report coming out. So this positive word in today's papers is a blessing indeed.
He's a great fan of the local football club up there in Liverpool too, isn't he?
Well, I'm afraid, Philippa, you're not allowed to say local. There are two of them. And he's a fan of Liverpool. I'm afraid the other team, Everton, I'm always the one who says, when I'm asked, do I support Liverpool or Everton, I say I'm too wise to answer that question. But I think by serving in Birmingham, Westminster, perhaps he has a space I don't have. You've got to keep both the blue and the red side of the city happy.
Do you know any particular anecdotes about his passion? I understand it is quite a passion for the sport.
Well, now I'm trying to work out when he was. There was some quite significant event recently when I was really rather busy, and I was quite surprised to hear that my Archbishop from Birmingham, he was free to be watching Liverpool play where I was slaving away in the same city. So I, you know, could have felt aggrieved, but I'll always be generous.
What do you think perhaps may be at the top of his agenda there in Westminster? I mean, he's well known for many things, for interfaith dialogue and ecumenism. What do you think perhaps may be his priorities over the coming years?
I think in a way you will have heard, and most people heard, I'm sure, of the huge turmoil occurring just at this moment in terms of what's happening with our parliament, parliamentarians. I get the feel that in a sense, the agendas are changing with such rapidity. We're still seeing through the consequences of the credit crunch. There's quite a crisis in terms of where Parliament goes from here. Do we need an election? What would happen if there is one? What's going to happen to the two-party system? We have elections to do with Europe coming up in just, 10 days' time. So in a strange way, I don't think anybody at the moment would say, well, this can clearly be my priority on agenda, that it's a very much a time to, I think, to say, well, what are the underlying issues? And there are some huge issues about integrity. There are issues about how does our constitution need reviewing? And from time to time, the issue has been raised, for example, about the position of the Church of England. And all these issues, I think, there's quite a melting pot at the moment. So I think somebody who, as he is, can handle a brief, I suppose, is one way of describing it, and master a brief, and then bring to situations a clarity and a structure to be able to go forward. I think that's all going to be put him in good stead.
As I said, when he was up there in Birmingham, he became well known for relations, particularly with the Muslim community. Of course, such a huge Muslim population up there, but also Liverpool with its very strong ecumenical background. I imagine these will be quite a central theme for him.
Absolutely. And also, with ecumenism was one of the strong features of his time in Birmingham and with the Bishop of Birmingham as well. So I think all of these things are going to be so very important. But all in a state of flux. I mean, the situation which the Church of England and the worldwide Anglican Communion is facing, some of their very difficult questions, that they keep on, if you like, changing the context in which we have to accomplish the charter of the Second Vatican Council for ecumenism, for the way we relate to the Jewish faith, the other religions. It's an agenda. All those agendas are clear, but the context is changing with such rapidity.
Finally, as a friend, something that you can tell us about him and ways that he's become particularly close to you as a friend.
Yeah, I would put it this way, that because of the way our Bishops' Conference works, and once or twice I've had to stand in and chair our meetings, our normal custom is that whoever's Vice President says thank you to the President. Well, when I had to move up one and act as President for whatever reason, Vincent always managed with a marvellous twinkle in the eye to put in a delightful sense of Scouse humour into his way of saying thanks. And that to me is very precious, affirming, but with a twinkle in the eye.
So your message for him as he faces this big day?
Curiously, I'd stand by the last thing that the late, great Bishop of Northampton, Frank Thomas, said to me last time he spoke to me. He said, Patrick, be joyful. I would say, Vincent, be joyful.
And my thanks there to Archbishop Patrick Kelly of Liverpool, the outgoing Vice President of the Catholic Bishops' Conference in England and Wales. Meanwhile, as the new Archbishop was being installed in Westminster, the British Parliament continued to be rocked by the so-called expenses scandal, which broke after newspapers began revealing details of MPs' expenses claims. A number of parliamentarians have already announced their resignations since the revelations began 2 weeks ago, and some observers are questioning the ability of the government to continue without calling an early general election.
We have to say sorry. And you know, let me on this programme again say how sorry I am that people in a difficult time have seen in Parliament people in their eyes, and in some cases, very clearly, abusing the system. It's wrong and they should be punished for it.
Sean Woodward is MP for St Helens South in Merseyside near Liverpool, and he also serves as the government's Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. On Wednesday, he met with Pope Benedict and held talks with the Vatican Foreign Minister, or Secretary for Relations with States, Archbishop Dominique Mamberti, as well as visiting the St Egidio community for a discussion on reconciliation in Northern Ireland. He also found time to drop into our studios and tell me more about his visit to the Vatican.
Well, the Vatican has obviously always taken a very strong interest in the peace process in Northern Ireland. And after the attacks we had in March of this year in Northern Ireland with the murder of the soldiers and the PSNI officer, the Pope was very clear in his views about this. He demonstrated very clearly his shock and condemnation of the violence in the way that he responded. And we were able to talk about what had happened. And I was very touched by actually not just his general level of interest in the peace process, but his very obvious, specific knowledge of what had happened in March and his concern for the families of those who were murdered and for the welfare of those families now. And then again to ask how the peace process was developing. And I was able to talk about how obviously the Catholic Church has been so important in helping the peace process come about, the continued work, the outstanding work of people like Cardinal Brady, who really has been a leading light in bringing people together and reaching out from one community into another. And specifically with the Pope, we're able to talk about the Prime Minister's visit back in February, and the Prime Minister, as you know, expressed his wish that the Pope would actually make a visit to the United Kingdom. We talked about the hope that I have that the Pope will come to Northern Ireland. We discussed that. We discussed the Pope's obvious continuing interest shared with the Prime Minister in the developing world. So we were able to touch on a number of issues, which I know, and very clearly I think the families will be very comforted to know that the Pope spontaneously brought up the attacks, wanted to know more. It was a very special meeting.
Let's go back to those attacks in March, the shootings of the two soldiers and the murder of the police officer. They caused obviously great concern, with many people asking if perhaps the Troubles are not really behind us but could at any point rear their rather ugly head again. Do you share that view or not?
I think you'd be foolish to be complacent when there are 200 or 300 people who have refused to accept the Good Friday Agreement, the St Andrews Agreement, the agreement made between Peter Robinson and Martin McGuinness as First and Deputy First Ministers at the end of last year, that there would be a process leading to completing devolution of policing. That there are a group out there who won't accept that. They believe that violence is the only way forward. So you should never underestimate people who are prepared to murder, and I don't. But we have a very good police service in Northern Ireland today. They work extremely well. They prevented these people from succeeding in murdering people in the last 10 years until this year. And I pay huge tribute to their work. So I'm mindful of the damage that 200 or 300 people who won't accept the peace process can do. But, you know, the really interesting thing is they only did it because the peace process and because the political process is working. They did it because they realised that very shortly the First and Deputy First Ministers have set in train a process to complete devolution in which Northern Ireland's elected politicians will take responsibility for everything in Northern Ireland, including policing and justice. So, if you like, the bad guys and their criminals were doing this because they realised that the politics is winning. And they did it precisely because they realised it was about to complete that victory. So they did it to try and stall the peace. And the extraordinary thing, and even I was surprised, was how the politicians responded, because in the past they would have responded as a Catholic, as a Protestant, as a Unionist, as a Nationalist, or as a Republican. They actually responded as one. They gave a unity of purpose to their response, which actually demonstrated that the peace process and the political process is wider and deeper and stronger and far more greatly rooted in the community than any of us dared hope. And of course, it was the community which came out. It was a Catholic priest leading his parishioners out of a church in Antrim on the Sunday after the boys were murdered at the base to go and visit the site where those boys were murdered. So we saw a community saying, we don't want this. We're not going back to that.
And yet the risk from this small group, as you say, but it remains a high risk, doesn't it?
It is a high risk, and you should never take anything for granted. But remember that during the core years of the Troubles, nearly 4,000 people lost their lives. This was the first time two soldiers, albeit not soldiers, based in Northern Ireland, for Northern Ireland's sake, they were actually simply garrisoned there as part of the United Kingdom on their way to work for humanitarian work in Afghanistan. This was the first time in 10 years that we'd lost a police officer or soldiers. So it's very different. But, you know, the best solution to this is for the politicians to complete the process. The best solution is for the people of Northern Ireland to resolutely say, no, we're not going back to that. And they've done that. And that's how we will keep this peace process and political process going.
You mentioned the important role that the churches, church leaders in particular, have played in promoting reconciliation. Do you think there's more they should be doing, though? I mean, it's not a uniform picture, is it? It depends where you are in Northern Ireland.
I have to pay tribute to the work of the churches in Northern Ireland and throughout the whole of the United Kingdom and in the Republic, because they've tirelessly worked. And not just there. You know, the Catholic Church, for example, in America during the 1980s, which was working so assiduously to try and persuade the men of violence to find another way of doing it, that work continued in the 1990s. There is still work to be done, because as we know, there are still some people who will not give up the violence.
The economy in Northern Ireland as well is struggling. It's apparently expected to grow until 2010, unemployment increasing. These kind of problems in some ways provide a seedbed, don't they, for further violence. Are you concerned about that?
A failure for people to feel that resources, whatever they might be, are fairly distributed is often a cause for unhappiness. And unhappiness can sometimes result in people completely misguidedly thinking that that's an excuse for violence. It's not. Whatever the failures of our society, whether they be in the United Kingdom or Ireland or in any part of the world, there is never an excuse for crime. There is never an excuse for violence. But I think one of the real lessons for me in this recession is to remind me to renew my effort and those I work with in government that actually, so long as there is injustice, so long as people can feel, and you see it in the Middle East, you see it in the Holy Land, you see it in places where you have Palestinians on one side of a street, Israelis on another, where one has 20 times the disposable income of the other, and the one with 20 times as much isn't rich. That's just that the one without is so poor that you can see how this breeds discontent, even hatred. That's still not an excuse for violence. It's never an excuse for bombing. It's never an excuse for crime. But it is a call to all of us who want to see a better world to understand that getting economic fairness there, and that doesn't necessarily just mean aid. It means providing jobs. It means making trade possible in Africa, for example. It means not having protectionist measures which make it impossible for countries which are almost enslaved in poverty to trade their way out. We've got a duty, a moral duty, and an economic responsibility. And if there is a good thing to come out of this recession, it must be to remind all of us to renew our efforts to build something on the other side of this economic recession, which is fairer. And if we can do that, then I think we will build a fairer world and we'll see less violence.
The current exposure of all the MPs' expenses, which is causing such uproar in the media, at least in Britain, how much do you think that this will be a major crisis for the government? Do you fear for the future of the government because of this?
The expenses crisis in the United Kingdom at the moment is a very serious issue. It's a serious issue for which I think as members of Parliament we need to learn some lessons. Very quickly, the Prime Minister has put together some interim proposals, which he has, I think, by and large, achieved broad agreement on with the other party leaders, which I think we will implement very quickly while we wait for a long-term solution. And this has got to be statutory. We members of Parliament have got to stop regulating themselves. This has got to be done by an outside body. And abuse has got to stop. People mustn't fiddle expenses. It should be no more tolerant in a recession than a period outside of a recession. You should not profit from your expenses. But I'm also keen that we don't end up at the end of this with a system which means only rich people can be members of Parliament. You know, I'm a working class boy who happened to marry somebody with a great deal of money. And clearly some people find that quite difficult. Some people think, well, you know, why should I have any expenses if, after all, I've married somebody who's got a lot of money? And begs a rather important question, which is, are we defined only by the person we're married to or a partner of? And I think we spent about 100 years in the 19th century and early part of the 20th century saying that women shouldn't be defined by their husbands. So I find that rather funny for me. But I actually don't take a cabinet salary. I've not taken £160,000 of salary for the last 2 years because I thought that was right in this climate. And people have got to look at their own situations. But, you know, there are nearly 650 members of Parliament. Pretty much every one of them came into it not to make money. They could have made a lot of money elsewhere. They didn't come into it to fiddle expenses. That doesn't mean to say they haven't abused the system in some isolated cases. And in some cases, they haven't actually, perhaps in some people's eyes, in buying televisions and so on, taken perhaps more than in a recession, particularly people feel is unfair.
That's the key, isn't it? The people are very concerned.
So we've got to get that right. We've got to eliminate the unfairness. And you know, I had a colleague who said on a programme recently to the audience when they were barracking her, well, you don't understand. Well, the truth is, I think the public do understand.
But are you concerned it can bring the government down?
Well, anything could bring a government down. But, you know, let's equally get a grip on this. I believe we can sort this out. And I believe it's up to members of Parliament to sort it. Right now, we're in the worst recession that we've known in our lifetime. It's not a depression like the 1930s, but I think without the action that Gordon Brown took to stop the banks from failing last year, that was copied around the world, and other world leaders came in the G20 with President Obama to London to learn what Britain had done. Without that action by the Prime Minister, I think this could have been a depression. Because if the banks had failed and people had systematically lost their savings around the world, I think that's what would have happened. Now, the question is, would we actually serve the country right now by saying, oh, we are so important in the mess that we've got ourselves into that you, the rest of the country, the other 60 million people, we're not going to worry about you for the next 4 weeks. We're just going to look after ourselves, sort ourselves out, get re-elected. Well, actually, I think that would be an abrogation of responsibility, which would be far greater than the expenses scandal. The expenses scandal we brought on ourselves, we must sort out, we must apologise for, we must be independently regulated, and the abusers must be punished, no question. But we can do that without an election. Actually, what we've got to do is sort ourselves out at the same time as we do the job that we should be doing to help people now. That's the right thing to do. And what Northern Ireland, I think, shows is that if you do the right thing and you work for long enough and hard enough, it comes right. So there are lessons for Northern Ireland for all of us.
And my thanks there to British Member of Parliament Sean Woodward, who is the Government Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.